From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for joining us for the weekly wrap-up of Connections. If you're new to Weekend Connections, this is sort of a highlight reel from the week on the show, and you can find it every Friday afternoon wherever you get your podcasts. Joining me for this week's episode is our Connections intern, Emma Ray Stein. She did some excellent reporting for us this week on the program, and we thought it would be fun to introduce her to you and include her on this podcast. Hi, Emma Ray.
Hi, Megan. Thanks so much for having me on today.
You're welcome. We're going to begin our week in review with a conversation about the late Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings. Representative Cummings died on Thursday at the age of 68 after challenges with a longstanding health complication. Colleagues described him as having a monumental presence and as someone who could work across the aisle on a variety of issues. The son of sharecroppers, Cummings rose through the ranks as a respected civil rights leader.
His death came as a shock to many people, including local political analysts. In this clip, our guests discuss Congressman Cummings' legacy, but also warn against sanitizing that legacy. You'll hear Larry Knox, political and community engagement coordinator for 1199 SEIU, Michelle Daniels, a super Democratic volunteer, Paul Hippolyte, a political strategist, and up first is Tiana Magnon, a publicist, journalist, and political analyst.
I mean, of course, it was really sad. I think what really stands out to me is that this was living Black history. So much of when we think about Black history, it's older or, but this was that direct link to everything that we talk about in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s. But I think what really saddened me was that he literally worked until his death. Like, he never got a chance to retire. He never really got to, you know, not rest on his laurels, but actually enjoy that old age. And so for me, you know, I see him as definitely this amazing Congress, but I also see him as this person who literally worked until his death.
Larry, how about you? How did the news hit you?
It was very sad. I mean, the first thought I had when I heard about his passing was, I remember the last time I saw him on TV when, you know, the president's attorney was testifying and that last, you know, 9-minute closing he gave, which was, you know, patriotic, emotional, very real about how our country needs to be better and how he felt for Cohen's family. And he had the story about the braces when he was, you know, holding his, you know, seeing his daughter, and it was just very emotional. So my first thought was, you know, that decency that is so often lacking in our politics, and here was somebody who was, you know, on the grandest stage displaying that earlier in this year. So I just remember that loss, you know, not just for being African-American or being a Democrat, but just for, you know, our political discourse, that somebody like him is no longer here.
Michelle.
I felt shock for several reasons. Obviously, we lost a champion in equal rights for African-Americans, women, and just people in the shadows in general. You know, he was a major voice. Not only was he a voice, but he was, as Martin Luther King called, a drum major for justice. He talked a talk and walked a walk. And when I say walked a walk, I remember when the Freddie Gray events happened. And I often see politicians who walk away from the citizens. And here we have Elijah Cummings, Congressman Elijah Cummings, talking to the youth that we were told in the media to be afraid of. And the way I found out was really, really bizarre. Let me just preface it. I was in Washington, D.C. for a couple of days. And before that, I drove from Columbus, Ohio, from the presidential debates, 4 o'clock in the morning. So I haven't had a lot of sleep. So my girlfriend, who I forgot was staying in the room with me, yells out at 5:20 in the morning. I'm still asleep. Elijah Cummings has passed. So I'm looking around. I'm like, I forgot where I was. And I just was like, okay, I'm in a dream. That didn't happen. And so the first thing I did was I had to confirm with 3 different sources, and it was true. And I tell you, all of yesterday was humbling because I was surrounded by his peers. I was at a women's leadership conference, and the majority of the speakers were women, female House of Representatives members. And for dinner, I had a member at my table, Congresswoman Grace Meng, and to hear not just House members, but also senators like Senator Warren talk about her relationship with him, and Tom Perez choking up at the microphone. And it was just really, really, really tough. But I was in the right place to grieve with them because, you know, we lost a champion.
We talked during our very short break about concerns about sanitizing his reputation. That's something you brought up, Tiana, sanitizing his legacy. Talk a little bit about that, Tiana. I know that
when
we look back on him.
I think the perfect case is Dr. Martin Luther King.
For sure.
We love sanitizing his legacy. We don't even talk about his anti-war, his ideas on the class war. We don't mention any of that. We don't even talk about the night he was assassinated, what he was doing in Memphis.
We do all the time as a union member.
Okay, yes,
was
you do.
A union strike, yes,
he was. And so my fear is that this brave, brave stalwart who stood up against so many big things, homelessness. He literally just was working on legislation with Elizabeth Warren to get cities way more funding for opioid issues. And so my concern is that when we look at the big things that we were fighting for, we're only ever going to talk about his grace. And he was so nice and how hard he fought. But we're not going to talk about the systems that he fought against and how we're still fighting against these systems. So I would say that if we're going to talk about his legacy going forward and we're going to make sure it's not sanitized, we really have to couch it in understanding the systems he's fighting against, how long he's been fighting against them, and how long we will fight against them.
Why is Baltimore a poor, downtrodden, let's use Trump's words, rodent-infested city? That didn't happen by mistake. It didn't happen on its own.
Right.
We can talk about redlining. We can talk about housing policies. I know we talked about that the last time Larry and I were on the show. These are decisions that the state and federal government have made over decades that we need an Elijah Cummings.
Next, New York State is cutting funding for several organizations that serve the homeless population. The cuts total more than $500,000. Many Rochester community members fear the impact that this could have on the safety of individuals experiencing homelessness in the city.
In this clip, you'll hear John Sosa of the Salvation Army discuss Tent City on Broad Street and his concerns for the homeless population as winter approaches. But first, here's Angela Panzarella, CEO of the YWCA, discussing the steps that the association is taking to keep their homeless programs open throughout the winter.
We're going back to the state to try to see if there's any recourse there. We'll try. I'm not optimistic. We're certainly reaching out to private funders where we can to seek some funding. We're also going back to the county and asking the county to reconsider the reimbursement rate that they're paying. Because one way or another, if we can't service the population, if we have to shut beds, that's going to put an impact on the county one way or another. They may need to shift population to hotels, which are more expensive and certainly a much less effective alternative.
Different organizations do different things, and throughout this hour, all of our guests are going to talk about the services they provide and the work that they're doing. And I know you don't like to do this, but give me the worst case scenario with these cuts and where you are now. Who is going to be impacted if the worst case scenario happens?
The worst case scenario is that we either need to scale back or potentially even discontinue our homeless program. For our population, we typically serve nearly 600 individuals each year, women and families, and in fact, we have at least half of the people we serve each year are children. That leaves more pressure on whatever shelters remain and certainly more pressure on the county, who are already placing many individuals every day in hotels because there was not enough capacity in the community as it was.
And, look, I don't mean to be trite or even cable newsy about this, but I do want to ask you if you are angry or if you're more confused and if you think that this is just a misunderstanding.
I think the state unfortunately made decisions about how to prioritize the funding at a macro level. I certainly would urge the state to, when they're making decisions of this kind, to seek input from the communities. In Monroe County, we've got a very effective process and group together to come together of agencies and government officials to assess what the needs are in our community to serve the homeless population. I'm frustrated because I think the state made the decision with, I understand, limited funds and lots of demands for those funds, but I think they made the decision without really listening to the communities.
All right, let's go around the table. John Sosa, next up, he's with the Salvation Army of Greater Rochester. And John is not the person whose job is to crunch all of the numbers. But my understanding, John, is we're talking nearly $250,000 for the Salvation Army lost in this funding. You do some of the work on the ground. What are your biggest concerns about the impact here?
I'm more boots on the ground. Just Sunday night, I was actually in Tent City, just off of Broad Street. They call it Peaceful Village, but we were out there just feeding people and giving them clothes and hats and things like that. And my fear is to see that as we lose beds, as we lose services, we're going to see more people out there in places like Tent City. And I've actually had the opportunity to go inside a few of those tents, and it's really sad and heartbreaking to see how people live. And we got thousands of people driving by in their cars every day, not realizing on the other side of that fence there are people just living in filth and misery. And my fear is just to see people, more people out there.
Is that inevitable with these cuts?
I would imagine so. I can't really forecast the trickle-down effect, but I know for our own local Salvation Army, we're going to lose beds. Clients are going to lose services. Perhaps some of our case managers will lose jobs. I just moved here from Ohio 3 months ago to work with the homeless. I come with about 20 years of experience of working out there in the streets, under bridges, in the woods, and I might lose my job. I don't know. I'm not really sure how this trickle-down effect's going to happen, but it's definitely, when you lose $250,000, we're definitely going to feel the pain.
John, is there any, you know, is there any excuse for giving the agencies so little notice here and this close to winter? I mean, do you feel at the very least that communication could have been better?
I would imagine so. I know my bosses were very heartbroken and very concerned. In fact, many of the employees from the Salvation Army are at the divisional headquarters right now in Syracuse trying to figure out what we're going to do. So I think we're all kind of taken back. Mm-hmm. I know I was. Again, I just moved here 3 months ago, and I might be packing my bags.
Wow. Wow.
Next, can women be fired for being pregnant? The law says no, but over the past week, thousands of women across the country have shared their stories of pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. The conversations were sparked by Senator Elizabeth Warren, who said that she lost her teaching job in the early 1970s when she started a family.
We discussed the issue with our guests, who talked about the legal aspects of pregnancy discrimination and the personal toll it can take. In this clip, you'll hear Heather Hare, Senior Director of Corporate Communications for WNED, WBFO, and a mother of two, Sharon Stiller and Beth Cordello, two employment law attorneys, and first, here's Kara Austin. She's a graphic designer and marketing professional who joined us to share the discrimination she faced when she returned to work after having her son.
It was tough. That transition, I think, for just about everybody is tough at first. And within the first month I was back, I think because I had been, you know, new mom, not sleeping a lot, my immune system was wiped out and I ended up contracting pneumonia. And I realized I had it, went to urgent care, got the diagnosis, they gave me antibiotics, and I was feeling pretty good. That was on a Friday. I felt good by Monday. So I went back to work and I started to feel better and then started to feel worse, followed up with my regular doctor. And it was like a nightmare day because I went to the doctor for my follow-up in the morning. They were like, you still don't seem good. We're going to send you for an x-ray. While I was waiting for the x-ray, my daycare provider called me and said, your son has a lot of gunk in his eye and you need to come pick him up now. And so I left the x-ray, went to go get my child who definitely had conjunctivitis, brought him to the pediatrician, met my husband at home with our son because I was like, things are just kind of, you know, I can see where this is going. And my doctor called and was like, yeah, your pneumonia is worse. You need to stay home. Like, you can't just keep going back to work. So they wrote me, like, we're writing you a letter. You need to stay home for a week. And so I did that because it was the threat of, like, you will run yourself ragged and go to the hospital. So I took care of myself. My poor husband moved into the living room with the bassinet with the baby so we'd be separate. And that was really hard, too. I had to be separate from my child who was only a couple months old. And took care of myself and got back to work. But then a month or two later, when it was the end of the year and time for reviews, it was brought up during my performance review. And after, you know, kind of glowing feedback for other things, it came down to, they're like, well, we just don't feel like you're still as dedicated to making it into the office as you had been. And I looked at my supervisor and I was like, I don't understand what you mean, because outside of my, I'm calling maternity leave, but again, it's short-term disability, and having to stay home to recover from pneumonia, I had been there. Mm-hmm. And I kind of pressed a few times, saying, like, what are you talking about? Am I not getting stuff done? And they're just like, well, we just do better when you're here, and just kind of danced around it. And leading up to my maternity leave, and I feel like, Shay, they did not ask me to do this, I had done all of my work that I knew would happen while I was out, so that, you know, having a particular skill set that was unique to me in my department, I didn't want anyone to be left with something they couldn't handle. But it felt like even that didn't balance it out. They were just kind of, you know, bean counting hours I was in the office and not taking anything else into effect. Mm. And for me, that was my, like, okay, well, I have a baby. I had pneumonia. The baby's going to get sick at some point in the future. I may get sick again. Maybe this isn't the right place for me. And so mm-hmm. I started looking for another position, even though up until then I had loved my job. But It kind of goes back to what you talked about, having to hire a new employee. If someone's really dissatisfied with the working environment, they'll leave.
Yeah. I feel like it's a perception. When I was pregnant, early on in the pregnancy, I had been given a big project, but there was a senior person who was going to be helping me with it and then a junior person. And then like two-thirds of the way through, they pulled the senior person and then still expected me to deliver the same project that they had hoped for. And when I couldn't do that because I had a busy job other than that project, I got pulled into a meeting with one of my bosses, and he said, you know, I think, you know, we're just thinking maybe you're just kind of distracted by the situation you're in, because it wasn't a planned pregnancy. So it was stressful, but the only place where I wasn't distracted was at work. And so I had to lay it out that, no, these are the reasons why these other things didn't end up being a part of the project. And those were decisions that you guys made. And they quickly ended the meeting and shuffled me out. But it's a perception that if you're pregnant or you're a new mom, that you're going to be distracted. When in my reality, and I think in Kara's, I was more efficient, more focused when I was at work.
I had the opportunity to be the proverbial fly on the wall in partnership meetings at a former law firm when I was the sole female partner, you know, all the guys. And one of the male partners who I did not perceive of as being terribly productive was discussing whether we should be bringing in somebody else, woman, who we knew was pregnant. And he gave voice to all of those perceptions. Wow. But I had the ability to be in the room and to really contest it. Mm-hmm. So with him, why do you think that? And what kind of hours would you require? And why would you require different hours and things of the sort? But those are the most difficult issues because they're so under the surface.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was going to say, during the performance review that you had, Kara, or that meeting that you had, Heather, they're dancing around the issue, using language, are you distracted by the situation?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Come on. Yeah. Are they allowed to do that? How can you report that? I mean, you were penalized, essentially, for being out sick or taking care of your son. Beth and Sharon, what do you do about that?
So, you know, under the law, you can't discipline someone or give a poor review because they've taken protected leave, they've availed themselves of an accommodation, you know.
But it's also not an excuse for not performing your job duties. So it just depends on how people frame it. And it sounds to me like in both of those situations, you know, what they were saying is that we don't think you've got 100% of your attention at work when you really did. Mm-hmm. And they knew enough to know that they couldn't say, well, we think that you haven't been 100% attentive since you've had your child. And they knew enough to not say that, but which is why they used the euphemism for it. What a shame that there couldn't be a real conversation. They could have retained, you know, both of you as employees.
You know, and the job I got after that, I had a second child, and then I stayed for 8 years. Mm-hmm. They were incredibly supportive. There was daycare on campus. Everybody was very accommodating, and we all pitched in and helped each other out when we needed to. And it was just a very different working environment. And because of that, I stayed much longer, never taking a promotion or anything along the way. I was just happy to be in a place where they were supportive.
Yeah, I tell folks of the job I had after that they didn't care in the best way possible. So if I called my supervisor, I was like, you know what, my kid's sick, I have to give him daycare. He's like, all right, do what you got to do. There wasn't that same, I didn't feel that pressure. I knew I was doing my job. I knew I was doing it well. And so did the people who it mattered to at my job.
We'll end the week with the story of Nicole Collins, a local mother. When Collins became pregnant with twins, she learned that one of her babies, William, suffered from intrauterine growth restriction. Despite this diagnosis, the thought of returning home from the hospital without two babies never crossed her mind. But Nicole was 32 weeks into her pregnancy when William passed away unexpectedly.
At 35 weeks, she gave birth to two babies, Asher, who was healthy, and William, who was stillborn. Now she shares her story to illustrate the impact of stillbirth on the lives of new mothers. Let's listen.
This was my first pregnancy, and it's funny, at the beginning of the hour, you talked about, you know, women getting to that 12-13 mark within their 12-13 week mark within their pregnancy and kind of thinking that they were out of the woods, and that's kind of how I felt too. I went through IVF. It was not very easy for my husband and I to get pregnant. But once we kind of got out of the first trimester, you know, I didn't know what stillbirth was until William died. So my pregnancy was fairly easy, nothing exciting, with the exception that my son William had intrauterine growth restriction. So he was just a little smaller than his brother Asher, but that wasn't like, there was never a thought in my mind that we wouldn't bring home two healthy babies. It was more just, we're going to monitor you, maybe induce you a little earlier than normal. We're just going to keep an eye on things. But, you know, I never thought that I wouldn't bring home two healthy babies. At 32 weeks at this point, we were being monitored every week, ultrasounds, non-stress tests. And at 32 weeks, we went in for our ultrasound and they couldn't find Will's heartbeat. His brother Asher was doing just fine, but Will had passed away. I continued to carry both babies until about 35 weeks. And I delivered them both, one child deceased and one child living. So yeah, that's my story.
Can I assume that the least helpful thing someone might say is, well, at least you have one?
You can assume correctly.
And can I also assume that sometimes people who are well-meaning might say that?
Absolutely. There's a lot of things over the past several years that have been said to me, and I do believe that people are well-meaning, but a lot of it has hurt. Just because I have a healthy son does not take away from the fact that my son died. A lot of people have said things like, well, at least you have Asher, or, you know, at least you have a living child, or, you know, at least you have one. Do you have children?
I have one, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Heather, I believe, has said to her partners at one point, Heather, I hope, Dr. Florescu had triplets. And, you know, she had said, the best way I can explain it is, if she didn't bring home one of her children, would that make up for the would the other two make up for the fact that she didn't bring home one? It doesn't make it stink any less. And if there was any saving grace in it, it was that I kind of didn't have a choice but to kind of power through everything because I had a living child to go home to.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can find Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Emery Stein.
And she did a great job. And I'm Megan Mack. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will talk to you Monday.